I panicked briefly yesterday. Somebody came in and said I was wrong.
House Committee on Revenue for Wednesday, May 27, 2009 will come to order. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2649. I'm going to pass the gavel to Representative Bailey, and Senator Burdick and I are going to open this one. Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the House Revenue Committee. My name is Phil Barnhart. I'm the state representative from House District 11. We're here this morning to talk about a gut and stuff for the bill that's in front of you. I will say now that the those who are frantically reading that bill should ignore it because it's not what we're going to deal with. The amendment that we are going to propose has not been finished yet. But I want to describe. We want to describe what we are up to. The key to this particular revenue bill is that it's primarily a personal change in the personal income tax at the very high end. I like to refer to it as the Obama tax because it contains many of the elements of the proposals that President Obama made during the presidential campaign about when he recognized the need long-term to raise revenue for the United States. The keys to this particular proposal is while it raises a substantial amount of money, very close to $500 million, there will be no changes in tax rates for those earning less than $250,000 a year filing a joint return, or $125,000 a year for a single filer. So the package is focused only on households earning over $250,000 or $500,000 a year. And that is that's a key for our discussion as we prepared this proposal. Because for several reasons, probably the most important one is that Oregon has a relatively flat tax system when you combine all of state and local taxes and consider that consider a percentage of household income. When you look at the division of the quintiles in Oregon, you discover that the tax rate is a slightly bit lower at the bottom 20%. Then it increases in the middle 60%, a small amount, and then it declines again at the top. This proposal will take that decline away, and because of the nature of the taxing system, we're talking about a relatively small number of taxpayers who make a very large amount of money. So that's the essence of the proposal. Senator Burdick is going to explain some of the details, and then I think we'll be ready for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Vice Chair Bence and Mr. Vice Chair Bailey and members of the House Finance Committee, House Revenue Committee, excuse me. My name is Ginny Burdick, and I do represent the people of Senate District 18, and I'm chair of the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee, and have worked on a group with Chair Barnhart to get this proposal together. As Chair Barnhart said, this package affects only those households who make $250,000 or more at the as a joint return. Households earning less than $250,000 will see no changes in their tax rate or in their deduction status from this package. The proposal increases the top rate of income tax by 1.8% on households earning between $250,000 and $500,000 on a joint return. And for households earning over $500,000, the rate increases by another 0.2%, but again, only on the amount of earnings over $500,000. So all these rates are marginal rates. In addition, the package phases out the federal tax deduction, where you deduct your federal taxes from your state taxes. That phase out starts at an adjusted gross income of over $250,000. And all components of this plan will begin with the 2009 tax year. And the estimated revenue we're going to get from this is about $504 million. Now, the additional components of the revenue plan that are appropriate here to describe are a one-year federal tax exclusion of the first $2,400 of unemployment benefits. That is picking up the same provision that was in the federal stimulus package from which we disconnected early this year. This also applies to the 2009 tax year. This will have a revenue cost of approximately $32 million a year. And to offset that, in addition to the larger package, we are working a program is working its way through the revenue committees to have a general tax amnesty program that will start hopefully 91 days after sine die, which is the soonest a tax administration measure can start. And this will have an estimated revenue gain of $16 million. The package, the amnesty package, just so you know, focuses on non-filers, people who are not in the system now, people who need to amend their returns or file in the first place. And so it's not going to be dealing with accounts that are currently receivable. Otherwise, the revenue would be much higher. And so the total revenue, after you subtract for the unemployment benefits generated by this package, is $488 million. And I would be happy to answer any questions.
Questions? Representative Brin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll have plenty of time for editorial comment, I'm sure, as we're moving the bill, if that's what's going to happen. We can save till then, talk about how the people in Clark County are going to absolutely love this. But my question is, how much consideration was given, forgetting about the individuals, forgetting about obviously well-paid individuals, how much consideration was given to the fact that the majority of small businesses in Oregon are S-Corps? S-Corps, if I'm not mistaken, would fall under this tax increase, and it would be a pretty dramatic, by my back-napkin estimation, make the small business tax in Oregon the highest in the nation for these companies.
Well, of course, this is not a business tax. This is a tax on personal income.
But S-Corps go through that. My question is, well, and maybe there's an exclusion for that.
It doesn't differentiate between income earned in the stock market, income earned through wages or salaries, or income earned by from pass-throughs, or some other method of making income. All income, assuming that it falls in what we count as income for personal income tax purposes, would be affected by the bill if the household has the $250,000 of income or $500,000 of income or more. And doesn't we didn't attempt to differentiate between the sources of that income. And, of course, the current income tax system doesn't either.
Given our Mr. Chair?
Yep, Paul.
Given our unemployment situation, given, I think, the comments that have come from here, that small business is the job generator of this state in good and bad times, ought we not to slow down a little bit and look at that aspect of it? I mean, it sounds to me like maybe it's unintended, but as near as I can tell, that's going to be the consequence of this bill. Even forgetting about the high-income earning individuals, it's not a very, frankly, a large, big, small business that earns $250,000 a year.
Well, the reality is, and of course, this is an ongoing conversation, I think. The basic underlying issue on these kinds of discussions has to do with the maintenance and the development of our economy. I have been convinced since before this crisis actually developed that the most important thing that the state government can do in terms of maintenance and development of the economy, when it comes to budget and tax issues, there are other things we do, but when it comes to budget and tax issues, is to make certain that basic public services are maintained and paid for. All business in Oregon depends on our education system. They depend on the government infrastructure that I talked about a little bit, I think yesterday, in response to a witness's testimony on a different bill. It depends on the wages earned by state and local employees who are paid as a result of the tax system. And those businesses depend upon the basic public services that we provide at least as much as any individual does or any family does. So when you're considering the balance between business spending, capital formation, and the development of or the maintenance of our government, you have to find the balance. I believe that this is an excellent package. It improves the progressivity of our tax system. It is a very small change for an individual family, and it will help us maintain our basic services in Oregon during this downturn and provide for the kind of development that we need in the long term to make certain that Oregon is successful. And I recognize that we sometimes disagree on where that balance ought to be. Where I think it ought to be includes things like this bill.
Mr. Walnut, with respect, my fear is that they can, these small businesses or medium-sized businesses can go to Idaho and find a tax treatment that's less than half of what this bill would do, or simply go across the bridge to Clark County and have it completely eliminated. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, one thing I neglected to mention is that the vast majority of small businesses in Oregon do not net for their owner $250,000 or more. There are some that do, but the vast majority of them do not.
Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Did you run some numbers on the amount, percentage-wise, that the phasing out of the federal tax deduction adds up to? Is there a? I know that we're looking at 1.8%, and then over 500,000, 0.2%. Is there a number that the phasing out that you could give us that someone over 250,000, what that would cost them?
Oh, someone over 200,000, what that would cost them?
Yes.
I'm going to have to turn to staff for that.
The phase out, it's Representative Benz, it's a phase out of the cap. So an individual person, if it were fully eliminated, say in 2009, the cap is projected to be $58.50. So if that were fully eliminated, it would be 9% of that $58.50. So. Are you talking about an individual perspective?
Yeah.
So 10% of the 10% of the 6,000 is about $600, a little less than $600.
Follow, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Thank you. We had a graph when we were talking about the corporate tax of how many corporations would be affected by that proposal. Do we have a similar graph on how many individuals are going to be affected by this proposal? Do we have a number?
Yeah, we know how many taxpayers are in these categories. Chris, did you have that?
I'm still working on compiling the exact numbers for those.
Okay. Now, we're talking about a very small percentage of the overall taxpayers. And, of course, one of the things to note is that as state taxes go up for these high-income earners, their federal taxes in many cases will decline because of the of their capacity to deduct state taxes from federal income.
I think your reference to the Obama administration's proposals is of interest because I'm guessing that the federal government is going to be coming out with a similar increase package proposal, which would might alter the foundation that you just referred to.
It's possible.
Yes. So I'm wondering, again, it happened that I had the Dr. Patowski on my little radio show to Ontario this morning, and I asked him the same questions that I think Representative Bailey had asked him before about the impact that this increase would have upon our economy. And it is of interest to me. We've had a debate then about the Keynesian element of this proposal, and that I don't want to quote him, but my take on this is that this has an arguable basis during a recession, but that would suggest that this should go away when the recession ends. But I don't see any temporary element here. So I guess I would like to go back and explain why this is not a temporary device, squaring with the Keynesian theory that some believe, and why it's permanent.
This is essentially a tax fairness measure. People at the highest levels of income in Oregon pay taxes at a lower rate than those at more modest levels of income. This measure would go a long way toward making the tax system in Oregon truly progressive. And so it is not intended to be a short-term measure, although now is a good time to enact it because we especially need the revenue in order to go part way toward balancing our budget. Everyone in this room knows, of course, that even with this bill, there will be very substantial cuts in our budget for this coming year. But the main impetus for this measure is not the recession. It's dealing with tax fairness.
Joining Representative Boone and his concern about people fleeing to Washington, that takes us back to the number of folks that would so flee. I guess the question would be, how many would have to leave before it would have a negative impact upon this this proposal? 10, 100? I'm just curious. Have you run those numbers?
Not yet.
It would be of interest to see because we'd of course lose the entire 9%. Or whatever it is.
If they no longer receive income in Oregon, that would be true. If they continue to work in Portland and drive across the bridge to get to work every day, they would continue to pay Oregon income taxes. The reality is that the issue that you raised is hotly contested. Do Oregon taxes actually cause people to flee to other states in abject terror of having to pay higher taxes? These are very slightly higher taxes. I would be surprised if they would have any significant impact on that. And, of course, people are moving in and out of Oregon all the time. We have net in-migration most of the time. I don't expect that to change.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The current federal rate, I have to ask Chris what the current top federal rate is.
35%.
And so this 9% added to it would take it to 44%. Is that correct?
Right.
What's the top rate now?
Well,
that's the top
rate
now.
That's what it is now.
10.8 or 11.
Okay, 11. So 11 added on to the top federal rate would take us to 46%. And then that would be then modified further if the current administration, federal administration, decides to raise it higher. So,
of course, the actual rate is lower than that because of the interaction between the two tax systems.
Well, follow up, Mr. Chair. Of course, there is a modification of that interaction by virtue of the removal of the deductibility of the federal tax, is there not?
On the state side, yes. Correct.
Right. So I just, it's interesting to look at just how much we're asking these folks to pay when we tack those two taxes together. But we're going to see that in some sort of format, I would hope, before we act on this. Thank you.
Representative Call.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, guys. We've been, I think there's been a bit of talk this session about shared responsibility, and I think there were a bunch of us who had a great concern about what would eventually come of that talk. And just like to say that I'm really proud of the proposal that's been brought forward. I think that you guys have kept faith with our talking points, for lack of a better word, that there is an ethos embodied in this that I think that many of us share. So just right off the bat, this is very heartening to me. I'm wondering on the other side. Connecting to the one-year federal tax exclusion for the unemployment benefit, I think that gets at some of my concerns, and I guess they're the obverse of the concerns down here, which is can we get greater tax relief for people who are truly struggling right now? Is there more we can do for those people who are at the exact opposite end of the spectrum of the folks that we're talking about here? And you know, I know that there's compromises in the works, and that's the nature of this process. But I want to know if there's any further movement we can do to help those people who are really on the margins.
Well, the most efficient way to deliver help to the lowest income earners is the earned income tax credit. We do have a bill over in the Senate. The revenue impact obviously is quite high, so it hasn't been in play, but we had a hearing on it earlier this session, and it really is the most effective way to deliver help to that population.
And then I just want to be real clear about what's happening at the top end here. What we're talking about is net profitability. That we're talking about with the S corps, people are getting passed through to them as their share, right, of profits above $250,000. So we're talking, just want to be very clear that we're talking about a very small group of businesses. And if you could just reiterate that point, because I think it's very important that we're clear that this is not harming the small business owner.
Well, it's important to understand that the $250,000 is taxable income, which means that the adjusted gross income in, I'd say all cases, is considerably higher, because the $250,000 is after all the deductions, any business deductions, any personal deductions, after all the Schedule A deductions from the federal form, after any applicable tax credits that the federal government or the state government grants. So it's a taxable income, which means that there's a lot more than that in adjusted gross income.
And I think that's part of the issue here is the process of sharing the pain, as it were. The reality is that a lot of people are in big trouble financially because they're out of work, and people who are, I'm sure, extremely surprised about that because they had good jobs and were doing well just a few months ago. Other people, and some of those people depend upon basic state services that we provide, which we are cutting because the budget simply won't manage to pay for all of them anymore, with 90-plus percent of our total budget going to the basic services. When you start cutting billions of dollars out of the budget, you have no choice but to cut those items, and, of course, they directly affect families with children, people who are sick, and other people who need state services. This is simply a way of help of getting those who are still doing very well in this economy to participate in that process. And then in the long run, of course, establishing a fair tax system that everyone participates in.
Thanks, guys.
And if I might ask a clarifying follow-up on Representative Call's question, that $250,000 of taxable income, is that per business or per shareholder?
No, this is per family. This is the personal income tax, so it's the taxes that are paid by a family. If you're a joint filer, these rates kick in at $250,000 and $500,000 for the family. So a family, of course, may have a wage earner and may have a business owner. There could be any number of combinations.
And so would it be correct to say then if I had an S-Corp, for example, that might have 10 partners that are joined together, that it would in essence be $2.5 million total for that business as opposed to that $250,000 cap?
Correct. If that was the income that they derived from the S-Corp, after deductions, after expenses.
Right. And if they distributed that evenly among the 10, each one would receive $250,000. Then, of course, on top of that, they would apply their personal deductions and other things of this that are applied both to state and federal levels. A few things that apply just at the state level, like some of the tax credits that we worked on in House Bill 2067. And so people in that situation would not come into this at all because their taxable income would be quite a bit below $250,000, the level at which this kicks in.
Representative Bentz?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I forgot to ask about self-employment tax, and it might be of interest to find out just how many of these folks that we are targeting with this proposal are self-employed, and take into account then that 15% that they pay, mm-hmm. Because of course they pay both sides of the 7.5. Mm-hmm. So we add that 15% into the 46% mm-hmm. number. Now, correct my thinking because I haven't looked at this kind of stuff in a long while.
Representative Bentz, I paid that tax for many years. it is deductible from the federal tax, so it's offset. The federal tax is offset by that amount.
And there's a limitation on the amounts that high-income people pay because there's an overall dollar limitation. I don't remember precisely what it is, but perhaps staff does.
It's around $90,000, I think, the cap on the self-employment tax.
Right, so that runs out at a considerably lower level than this tax kicks in.
Sure. Yes, I think one of the federal administration's approaches is to raise that cap, to maybe do away with it. So it's of interest to see mm-hmm. this proposal when we don't quite yet know, of course, what the federal folks are going to do.
Mm-hmm.
But it would be worthwhile to see how many of these folks that are targeted by this are self-employed so we can factor that self-employment element in. Because I know there's some other twists and turns to it, but I just don't remember them. Thank you.
Other questions? Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Going back to the temporary or permanent issue, this is statute, and so as we all know, nothing in statute is permanent. So any future legislature can adjust this in any way they want. So if they see that this is burdensome, it can be reduced simply by a 31 and 16 vote.
True. Representative Bentz.
Thank you for your indulgence, Mr. Chair. I would just say in response to Representative Riley's remark that it's the signal that we're sending to those who might want to leave the state, and the fact that we could hope that something might change in the future is of interest, but a temporary label on it would be a far better thing if indeed we were concerned about that.
And, of course, the schools that we support, the basic infrastructure that we support would be a signal that would tend to bring ambitious and capable people to Oregon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We hope. It would be of interest to see, maybe in your conversations you discussed this, how this particular device squares with the way Oregon used to do things, which I think was a broader means of raising revenue for the schools you're talking about. This seems to be a much more narrower focused device to pay for the educational things that are of such great importance. Is that true, or in the past, before Measure 5 and Measure 50, was the same narrow group of folks paying for the educational opportunities then enjoyed?
Before, the percentages were just about reversed. You had roughly 70% of schools paid for by the local property tax and about 30% by the state, and now those are reversed because of the impact of Measure 5. As you recall, Measure 5 imposed property tax limitations and said that the state would have to fill in to keep schools whole. And they actually pulled it off for a few years because of the economy. But it's over the years, school funding has, on a per-student basis, has declined.
When you focus myopically, this looks like a very large thing. When you look at it in the tax system overall, it's a small adjustment at the very top end where the tax rate in Oregon, overall taxes in Oregon, the rate tails off. And it's in that sense, it's a small adjustment. It makes a very small adjustment in the total receipts on the personal income tax. And I think I'll leave it there.
Thank you.
Okay, any other question from the committee, recognizing that we are in public hearing? Representative Bruin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two points. One, and I apologize, Representative Cole had asked a question or I think a confirmation. I was walking out at the door for a meeting I'd scheduled 2 days ago. I just to be clear, I think on the S-Corp situation, we're really not talking about profit that we would talk about if we were taxing a corporation with an income tax rate and they have their money they make, expenses, you get a bottom line, that's profit, and then we tax that. We're talking about the same sort of taxes, I think, unless I'm wildly wrong on this, that you and I pay. We receive income, whether it's our jobs here, our jobs outside of this office. We have our expenses, but that's not what we pay taxes on. We don't pay taxes on everything after we pay our mortgage and our car payment and our kids', lunch money. We pay taxes on the top line, and that's the same as the S-Corp. So $125,000 for an individual is not profit. It's income, and it's going to hit. I disagree respectfully, Mr. Chair. I think it's going to hit the vast majority of small businesses. But the question I want to ask actually has nothing to do with that. It has to do with charitable giving. When you were putting this together, was there any analysis, or if not, can we ask staff to put some analysis together on what will happen to charitable giving in Oregon if we implement these higher tax rates? It's my sense that those that make a lot of money give a large share, the majority lion's share of charitable gifts in the state. And I'm worried about the impact on charitable giving that an income tax increase or a tax increase like this would have. And I don't expect you to have the answer, but I think it's a question we need to talk about.
Well, it's interesting because we did consider that in our discussion about what form to use. We were considering other forms that would essentially do away with that deduction and others. This proposal does not do away with any of those deductions. Schedule A, which includes charitable contributions, is treated in exactly the same way as it is now for high-income earners. And, in fact, this probably would encourage greater charitable giving because the state's share of that will increase slightly for those people with very high incomes, rather than to decrease the appetite for charitable giving. Now, of course, there are limits established by the federal government on what portion of your income that you can contribute. But we're not making any changes in those aspects at all. And if this bill has any effect on high income contributions, it would probably be to increase them.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Not seeing any further questions, I will take the rare chair's prerogative to make a couple of quick closing points. I do think that as we hear the testimony and hear from you, and I appreciate the time and effort that you both have put into this, I think we would be wise to consider the overall tax burden and Oregon's relative ranking to other states in terms of the big picture of what sorts of taxes that we pay, as well as the benefits of what we get from those taxes. And I would argue that the benefits, especially of education, accrue to the same demographic that we are asking to step up and help pay. And that may be direct, but it may also, I think, more so be indirect, in the sense that these are the small business owners that are hiring a trained and educated workforce, that are providing health care to their employees, that are ensuring that they are in a competitive and robust business climate, and that that's what keeps people here, as much as the changes in the tax rate may have a small marginal effect to give them an incentive to leave. But the difference between our tax structure and Washington tax structure is so great already that a small targeted change to the top end is, I think, unlikely to have a major effect. And if you care to comment on that, that would be great. But I rarely get the chance to just mouth off. So.
Mr. Chair, I completely agree with that.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony today.
While we're waiting for the sign-up sheet, I just want to comment that Chair Burdick and my testimony on this bill and also on the corporate tax bill is indicative of the cooperation and work that we've been working on together. And I really appreciate her interest and her support as we worked on these proposals. We have a short list this morning.
It's very short.
Very short. Jim Welsh.
Mr. Chair and committee members, Jim Welsh here again for Taxpayers Association of Oregon. And looking at this bill, and you know, you heard our comments yesterday on 3405, and we're not in support of 2069 either, reducing the federal deductibility medical expenses. And looking at overall a number of things that we've been working on this session, I think I'll refer to some other places that we call tax increases, although it's a definition using fees instead of taxes, but a lot of our businesses, a lot of our individuals throughout the state will be faced with these if by June 15th or the week after you sign a die and these are all incorporated. And I refer to definitely the carbon dioxide tax that we're facing, water tax, insurance premiums for our health plan, corporations, individuals, taxes that may come out of this committee, and, of course, all the numerous agency fees that we're faced with. You add all those up, and you're really wondering what we're facing. What we contend in the Taxpayer Association that we have a voracious spending appetite that is not being contained here. We look at an ending fund balance back in 2008 at $4.9 billion, and we are looking at families having and businesses having to tighten their belts and make do through this economic challenge. And we contend that the state of Oregon should be doing the same thing, not looking at increases that you're talking about even today in 2649. Yes, there is some reference, even yesterday, I think, or the day before, no, yesterday it was in a Wall Street Journal about where some of the millionaires were going, I think, in the state of Maryland. And some tax increases there were rather negative and were taken that way by those who were earning at high levels. And they are not showing up somehow. And that could happen here in Oregon, too. I think we do have a very favorable taxing system at this point in time in the state. And that's why we contend we have to control, especially in these times, our spending. If we don't, I think we're going to be facing reduced spending by those who can afford it, those who still have their jobs, those of us who are still making some money. And that's what concerns us also, because that then slows down our economy over time. And we're still facing, as I talked about yesterday, into 2011 before we possibly will see a better economy. So those at the higher brackets are those that we want to spend. We want to be spending out there in the retail basis. Those who may be applying a few more employees or may be contracting with contractors for work that is necessary. And doing the things that we're doing, and if you accumulate all those and take a look at them, you're going, my goodness, what are we doing here this session? So, Mr. Chair, respectfully, I contend that we best tighten our belt buckle, definitely in our budget. In the last 3 weeks here that we're in session, we need to take a look at that, and I hope that's what the decision will be. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To his last point, what is the amount that we're closing this gap with cuts?
It's over $2 billion. I don't recall the exact number.
Thank you.
It's a very, very large number. Yeah. Other questions? Thank you, sir. We appreciate your testimony. Is there anyone else who would like to be heard this morning on House Bill 2649? Yes, please.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative.
While he's coming up, I'd like to say that last night I had a town hall and a constituent handed me a sheet of paper that I'd like to put in the record. It refers to the original bill, not the gut and stuff.
Right.
But I would like to give it to you so that it can be distributed, as I said I would, to the committee.
Great. We'll give it to Chris, and you can see that it gets distributed.
Thank you.
We'll be considering this bill.
I understand.
At least a couple more times.
And he did not know of these amendments when he handed me that last night, and I said I would be sure and distribute it.
Right. Thank you. Gentlemen, please.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, John Mullen, co-chair of the Human Services Coalition of Oregon. We have, as part of our tax principles, have talked a number of times during this session about those, one of them being fairness. And we appreciate the work that has been done on this particular bill. We're concerned long-term about fairness, but we also must note that we're very concerned about the budget that we face for the next biennium. This is in keeping with the work that the Human Services Coalition has done all session long about looking at ways in which we can raise the kind of revenue where people that have the means can share a bit more as part of that shared responsibility, knowing that down the hall in Ways and Means, the co-chair's budget's already out, and that has significant cuts in human services areas, even with $800 million in revenue being factored into that discussion. So when we hear discussions about tightening our belt and all that, I wonder at times if we are going to have pants left. So I'm very, very concerned about what we are facing in 09-11. I would just make one other very quick comment. The issue about the connect to the exclusion on the 2,400 of unemployment benefits, that's a concern to a number of our members, so we're happy to see that there as part of the whole fairness discussion. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mike Sullivan. I am the political director for the Association of Western Pulp and Paper Workers, and I'm going to throw another quote to you, Mr. Chair, and it's taxes are the price you pay for civilization, and the income tax in Oregon is basically flat, just like sales tax, and it's regressive, and this is a step in the right direction. If you have a Volkswagen and you have a Cadillac, you wouldn't pay the same insurance. And so if you make more money, you should pay more income tax. I'm now dealing with a lot of people that are laid off and permanently, and they've done nothing wrong. And so when you talk about taxes and feeling disheartened, these people are really at the bottom of the chain. And it's sad because, as I said, they haven't done anything wrong. They've come to work every day diligently in one place in St. Helens. The average age is 40, and they've worked 25 years or so, and they're out. And there's no prospects of any jobs like that in the area. So it's bittersweet, I guess, but this is needed. It needs to be done. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Representative Berger, and then Representative Paul.
Mike, I appreciate that your folks who are laid off are in dire straits and that they have done nothing wrong. I would equally submit that those people who own businesses who hire people and are making money have done nothing wrong either. And they do pay a higher rate of taxes. If you earn more, you pay more. So I guess I'm a little bothered by your implication that if you are making money, you are doing something wrong, and by hiring people in your business, you're doing something wrong in an economy where we desperately need the capital to make business grow, to get your people hired back.
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, no, I apologize. That's not my intent, because business is affected. But in the business of pulp and paper, we are now seeing the paper business go offshore. So it's hard for our workers to follow the paper.
I appreciate that, and I do feel for your people. I just didn't want to leave it.
Right.
Thank you.
I am sorry for that.
Representative Call.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I wanted to just thank you for bringing up the plight of folks outside of the metro area where I live. I took something different from your comments. The people I think you implicated who are doing something wrong is maybe the folks up here. I guess one of the things that I've realized in this process is that, we talk about 12.2% unemployment, but there are places all around our state that have had 12.2% unemployment for a real long time now, before this recession even started. And so I think it's a really important perspective that you bring. And I think that the discussions we're having here are about how we look at our system and see how we can not just get out of this crisis, but fix it and make sure your folks have opportunities again. So I really do think there are folks maybe doing something wrong. Maybe it's me. So I appreciate your comments. Thank you,
Mr. Chair. Representative Cobb, I don't think anybody here is doing anything wrong. I think it's a federal problem with our trade agreements, NAFTA, WTO, and the like. And until we fix that stuff, I don't really think there's much can be done on a state level that way.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you, gentlemen. We appreciate your testimony. With that, we'll close the public.
Mr.
Oh, there's some more people. More coming, please. Not many sign-ups, but we get more coming anyway.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tricia Smith. I represent Oregon School Employees Association, and I'm here to thank the chairs of the revenue committees and others for bringing forward this proposal to begin to add balance and fairness back to our tax system, for using the opportunity of this horrible financial crisis to do what should have been done more than a decade ago. We believe that these proposals are not punitive. First of all, let me say that I do not believe taxes are punishment. I believe taxes are part of our gratitude for living in a place that educates our children, cares for our elderly and our disabled, and helps those who are ill and can't help themselves. And, by the way, protects our communities from those who would do us harm. That's the point of our tax system. And it is grossly unfair at the moment. It is grossly inadequate at the moment. And all of our children suffer every day in schools for what they do not receive. In the good years, what they do not receive under this current tax system. We believe that all citizens of this community, of ours in Oregon, should willingly pay their share of taxes. And we believe a progressive system that is based upon your ability to pay those taxes is the best and most stable system. And we see these proposals as a piece of that. So thank you very much for bringing them forward. We support them.
Thank you very much. Please.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, my name is Dana Hepper. I'm the advocacy director with Stand for Children. And just wanted to touch on a couple quick points. One, I think Oregon has a structural deficit between what the services are that Oregonians want provided, public schools, health care, public safety, and what Oregonians are paying in tax dollars and what you all have to spend. And one clear example of that that I'm most familiar with is that we're just over, well, if the co-chair's budget goes through as written, we would be just over $2 billion short of funding the quality education model for K through 12 schools, which, as you know, is just one of many aspects of our state budget. So that means here in Oregon we have the largest elementary school class sizes in the nation, the fourth largest high school class sizes in the nation, one of the shortest school years in the nation, and a high school graduation rate that's just around the national average. We went without 24/7 trooper coverage for far too long, and I don't know even if we're quite there yet. And as others are much more familiar with than me, there are pieces of our human services social safety net that are inadequate. So that's my first point. My second point is just that our tax structure in Oregon is pretty flat right now. Just about everyone in the state pays 9 to 10% of their income in taxes, and regardless of how much they make. And that's when you look at property taxes and excise taxes on gas and cigarettes and those kind of things. Property taxes and excise taxes are, in their nature, regressive. Those who make less pay a higher percentage of their income in those taxes, and our income tax system helps to balance that out by being a more progressive system that's based on a percentage of your income. And so, of course, in any of these proposals, it's important to get the details exactly right before we move them forward. And I know that this committee is going to spend a lot of time hammering out those details. And I believe that this type of measure is something that can increase the fairness of our tax structure and help provide a solution where everyone's contributing to the solution of in our structural budget deficit. Thank you.
Thank you.
Jody Weiser with Tax Fairness Oregon. I want to speak to a couple of the questions that you raised. It appears that about someplace around 30,000 Oregonians would be affected by this tax change. That is about 1 in 60 families. It's not a real high percentage of our taxpayers. So we're talking about a small number of Oregon families who actually do as well as this provision would create a tax on them. Second, many people in this income category do not own businesses, or if they own businesses, the business is not necessarily where most of their income comes from. From the time I was 31 until I was 55, my tax form said I was a farmer. Yet during those years, it was our teaching salaries that brought in most of the income. In fact, I think we took out about $200,000 from the farm during those years and used it to educate children or do something else with the income. So while our tax forms would have put us in the category of small business owners, it wasn't what our income was about. And it wasn't what made the decision about how high our income was, because most of the money was staying in the business, not coming out and being used for something else. And so most small business owners, the same is true. They take out what they need to live on, and everything else stays in the business, so it doesn't show up as a taxable piece of income. It just shows up as business expense. Thirdly, if we did an analysis of what happens to a family with $50,000 of income and one with $500,000 of income, what could they not pay taxes on if they wanted to? Well, the family with $50,000 of income, if they had the average, if they used all of the benefits available to them in the federal code, could not pay taxes on $35,000. But, of course, actually, that wouldn't leave them with much to live on each month. So they wouldn't use all the benefits. They wouldn't use the HSA account fully. They wouldn't fund our 529 program. They would probably end up just getting mortgage interest and property taxes as their only deductions, because otherwise they wouldn't have enough to live on. The family with $500,000 worth of income at the beginning of their tax form would deduct $88,000 before they would start figuring out what they were going to pay taxes on, because they would fully utilize the 529 program, their HSA accounts, etc. And they would still end up with, after their federal taxes, with about $250,000 to live on. So there's a lot of give in the tax code already to wealthy families that keep them from paying taxes on more money than most American families actually make. And so if you're looking at a tax form that has a business owner and they're showing taxes, they're going to pay taxes on $251,000, and so therefore be taxed at a higher rate on that last $1. They probably had about $300,000 to $350,000 worth of income to begin with before they started figuring out all the deductions that they could take. So these really aren't people who just earned $251,000 and therefore get taxed at a higher rate on that last $1. They really had quite a bit of other income. Finally, to the question of families that move, I have on my computer a list of the Oregon families, the names that we all know that did not move, that I have verified nobody in the family moved out of state. And it includes names like Schnitzer and Gray and Boyle, Knight, etc. I mean, we have many, many families who do not move when they sell their business. We all kind of wish that Lauren Parks had taken all of his money with him when he moved to Nevada, after all. It would change our tax system considerably. Some people will move, and they'll move no matter what the tax rate is. I'll be happy to share with you a letter from my accountant, Pat Hanley. I asked him one day, so what is the evidence from your firm for people who move? And he and his partner got together and they wrote a letter for me after that. And they've been in business in Portland for 25 years, I believe is what they said. And they've had about 20 business families who sold their business during that period of time. Three of those families moved, two to Vancouver and one to Nevada, when they were selling their businesses. And he said these actually were the smaller, not the larger, businesses that were being sold, and that at least two of them would have moved no matter what the tax rate is. In other words, capital gains would have to be taxed at zero in order for them to be, they would move for anything more than that. And so that is a often spoken of issue. And yes, there is good evidence that some people move. All you have to do is drive across the river and drive along the railroad tracks, and you'll see a lot of very large houses. And they probably are not all supported by Vancouver businesses. There's no doubt that some people move, but you never really hear the names of those people spoken out loud. You know, you hear that, but you can name easily the people who have stayed. And mostly, that's what we choose to do. So I think that this is good law. I think it looks at our situation realistically and says we need to share the burden here. We can't just cut. It's going to hurt too much. We're looking at about $2 billion worth of cuts and probably less than $800 million in income to deal with our current crisis. And that certainly is a step in the right direction. We shouldn't go below this. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And, of course, that's with the adoption of this bill and the corporate tax bill, is the $2 billion in cuts. Without these bills, of course, it's much higher. Questions for this panel? Representative Bruin.
I assume we're at the end of this public hearing, so mine are not necessarily for the panel. They're just comments before we...
I think we are, although I had one person signed up, and we've already heard from six, so who knows?
Okay. Well, first of all, I just wanted to pose a question for staff. Jody mentioned this, and I think we need to have the data on this as we proceed forward, which is simply... In that category, Mr. Chair, the folks, the individuals that make 125, or the families that earn more than 250, it'd be nice to know how big a population that is within the filing group now, and also, just as importantly, how much of the current share they pay of current taxation, and what that share would increase to with the increases proposed in this bill. The second is a comment that it sort of stems from the conversation we had Friday with the corporate changes to today with the personal changes that we're talking about. We're asked to make a choice between $800 million per biennium in new taxes or cuts to services, higher ed, K-12, and I submit that that's a false choice, Mr. Chair, and I just want to get that on record. Even yesterday on the House floor, it was announced that the governor has a document that shows that we have $4.9 billion in ending fund cash balances, of which 71%, $3.5 billion of that, could be used at our discretion. So I think the choice isn't between cuts or taxes, Mr. Chair. The choice is between how we're going to fund those critical services. Are we going to fund them with new taxes, or are we going to fund them with the resources that the state already has?
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you very much, ladies. We appreciate it. Just one quick comment about the comment, if I may.
Sure.
The reality, of course, is that the Ways and Means Committee is looking very carefully at whatever ending fund balances there are in the various aspects of the state system, and I fully expect that it will use in the budget whatever it believes is prudently available. I don't think it's reasonable or realistic for anyone to expect that the Ways and Means Committee is going to propose major cuts in basic programs if it has funds available that can be used to fill those gaps.
That's good to hear, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
And with that, one more, please. Yes. Is there anyone else after these two who wants to be heard? Come forward, please. That's three. And then we're way past the number we had assigned up. We'll take these three, and then we will move on to other business.
Mr. Chair, I'll speak rapidly for once. My name is Ralph Groner with AFSCME. I just will try a different approach to these measures and support.
Can we hold you to that, Ralph?
Did you what?
Can we hold you to that?
Mr. Chair, he
you
said
can if
rapidly,
I speak rapidly.
Said rapidly, not shortly. Oh, okay, that's true.
The initiatives have put us where we're at. Sorry, folks. It's wrong to keep talking about smokes and mirrors. The speech on the floor yesterday, I'll go through that with individual legislators. If what they're really talking about is money that somehow is carryover, some of that money is called sweeping, that many of us are upset about because they're sweeping money that we use for our programs that are dedicated by statute. But we'll get into that later. Secondly, I've tried everything since 73 to fund this government correctly from the McCall tax plan. I'm up to here. We can't fund with smoke and mirrors. We have initiatives now take 50% by the public of your responsibility and says, here, you must do it this way. We tried a split roll. We as labor, we lost. You won, whoever was on the other side. Split roll is, no one's mentioned it here, but quite frankly, under Measure 5, the property tax rate benefited business in Oregon put us in the shorts, took it to our shorts with the individual homeowner. So we tried a split roll. We lost at the polls. We probably will have to try again one of these days. We've tried sin taxes. Only because we can't get a sales tax. I personally supported a sales tax as county commissioner four times. We have never been able to get a sales tax. We can't get a sin tax. We can't get a split roll. Quite frankly, we've got the voters who keep saying yes, 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 yes on ballot measures. And where we're finally at is looking at corporations going back to pay a bit more than back when I was here at 18 and 16%. That may seem high, but that was the corporate rate when I sat on this committee. Quite frankly, we need to remember that. And we lost that. So one of the reasons wasn't just initiatives. We began losing sizable amounts of corporate income tax in this state over the last 20 years. The other we said was the wealthy 20 years ago were paying a higher rate, and we lost revenue there, even though we were continuing to say, by the way, that tax break is that's good, that's okay, that's okay, that's okay. And the voter said, what the hell, let's put more people in jails. We don't have the space. We don't have the money. It doesn't matter. Frankly, where I'm at is on all of this is we have got folks in a lot of trouble that need help desperately right now, and the one way we have in front of us are these measures. So we at AFSCME wholeheartedly say we need new revenue, we support new revenue, but we have supported new revenue for years and years and years, and we have been unsuccessful. Hopefully this session we will not be. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Chair Barnhart, Committee for the Record, Bill Cleveland and Carpenter's Industrial Council. I won't be near as long. First, I want to show you, this is going to be kind of hard to see. I just got it last night, but this is the open mills in Oregon in 2007, these little tiny dots. And I can take an eraser and wipe out 10 or 12 more of them dots right now. Also, I want to show you, this is from the United States Department of Labor, Trade Act, and NAFTA decisions for Oregon. In 20 years, there's 180 mills in these pages. Oregon's lost its industrial tax base. Our other major problem has pushed us over the cliff, and I'm meeting with Senator Wyden this afternoon. We lost our national force. The only thing Oregon has that can maintain and create jobs is not ours. We've lost it. I personally, right now, I've fought for this issue for 25 years, and I think we've lost it. We'll never get it back. I'm positive. Who's gonna put up $200 million to put a few more mills back online where they're needed? Eastern Oregon and Southwest Oregon is gone, and that it's going to take $200 million to add four or five mills if we want to put them online. We want to, but we can't. Thank you.
Thank you,
Chair Barnhart, committee members. My name is Dick McQueen from Sandy. I'm a citizen lobbyist. I'd like to put I'm out of my depth on much of the information here that's been provided, but I'd like to put a little different face on it, reminding us, as I was reminded the other day driving through Representative Call's district, household goods sitting out on the side of the street, more than we're used to seeing, Vids, Davenports, but other household goods, stopping by a yard sale, giving the stuff away because they got to take off to Florida for a job. Things are very tough, as we know, as we're learning through the media, for a lot, for some people. I think the percentage we're hearing about is 12%. What I'm told is that that's probably more like 20, given the people that have given up looking for work. There are people in serious difficulty, really hurting. Some of our family and friends probably are experiencing that. We are in our family. At least it's a threat. The other side of the coin is if the 20% is a valid number, probably is, 80% of us are doing pretty well. Public employees are being asked to take a hit. Most of us that are not public employees are doing pretty well. We're cutting back a little bit. Our house values have dropped, our retirement accounts have dropped, but we're eating well. A little more cautious, but we're eating well. And we need to be more concerned about that very small percentage of us so far. I know we all hope it continues to be a small percentage that are really in serious need. And I just ask the committee to think along those terms when you're deciding whether some of us that are perhaps in the $100,000 range can afford to pay a little more. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Gentlemen, thank you very much. And with that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2649 and open a public hearing on House Bill, Senate Bill 496. Colleagues, now we get to the finance part of our job.
Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 496 comes to you from the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee. The history of this bill really goes back to the February 08 session, and those of you on the committee will recall that the Revenue Committee's draft of the bill had a bill drafted that required a report from the Treasurer on the Oregon Growth Account and the performance of the assets in that account. And Treasurer Edwards presented that report to the committee right at the end of the interim. But the concern was over the compatibility of the Oregon Growth Account, which is a sub-account of the Education Stability Fund, and that's compatibility with the reserve fund role of the overall Education Stability Fund, specifically concerned about the liquidity of the assets that are in the Oregon Growth Account. What Senate Bill 496 was requested by the chair and vice chair of the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee. They met with the treasurer and to discuss the original draft and produce an amended version, the Senate Bill 496A, and that's what was approved by the Senate, and so that's what you have in front of you now. It does three things. Let me say a couple things about the Oregon Growth Account first. It is a sub-account of the Education Stability Fund. It receives 10% of the lottery revenue that's flowing into the Education Stability Fund. So as you recall, 18% of lottery revenue or lottery earnings go into the Education Stability Fund. Of that 18%, 10% flows into the Oregon Growth Account under current law. The Oregon Growth Account is designed to provide venture capital for Oregon-based startups. It was originally established under the Education Endowment Fund, which was created, referred to the by the 95 legislature to voters and approved. That account was converted into the Education Stability Fund in 2002, again on a referral by the legislature. And so the Oregon Growth Account was retained within this new fund. So even though the overall fund changed, the Oregon Growth Account stayed within it. The Growth Account is managed by the Treasurer through the Oregon Growth Board. And the fund currently has a total of about $92 million committed to venture capital partners. Of this $92 million, about $46 million has been invested, and another $46 million is remaining to be called when those investment opportunities are deemed potentially profitable. The bill does three things. It redirects the Oregon Growth Account declared earnings that under current law go to the commercialized research fund, which as far as we've been able to identify and working with the Treasury does not have a clear purpose. What the bill does is redirect those declared earnings not to this commercialized research fund, but back to the General Education Stability Fund. The Treasurer in March declared earnings of $18 million. So that would potentially go back into the General Education Stability Fund under this bill. The other thing the bill does is it reduces the set-aside of incoming Education Stability Fund revenue from 10% to 5% for 4 years, starting July 1, 2009. And then finally, it requires the Oregon Growth Account Board to submit a report to the legislature prior to February 1, 2011. The report is to detail the performance of the Oregon Growth Account investments and make recommendations on the amount of the Education Stability Fund revenue that should be directed to the Oregon Growth Account over the long term. I do have a revenue impact statement for you in your packet. There. So if you have the staff measure summary, it's the other side of that. What I've tried to convey in the table there is no impact on the overall education stability fund, but the impact is to of the bill is to increase the liquidity of the dollars that are in the education overall education stability fund. What I refer to as the general account, those are not in the sub-accounts, will increase under this bill by $27.7 million for the 2009-11 biennium. The Oregon Growth Account, instead of receiving roughly $20 million under current projections, would receive $9.7 million less, with that flowing to the General Stability Fund. That's a result of reducing that diversion from 10% to 5%. And then the Commercialized Research Fund, that the direction of the declared earnings into that sub-account is changed by the bill, and therefore would not go into that sub-account. It would go instead into the General Education Stability Fund, and that's where you get the $27.7 million. There would be another 2 years of the 5% set aside for the Oregon Growth Account, so that is another $9.8 million for the general account in 11-13. And then in 13, what the bill does is restore the 10% set aside for the Oregon Growth Account, so it would go back to current law. So I'm happy to go through the bill if that would help.
I think it would. I think it would also be useful to talk about the history of this kind of action by the legislature. I'm aware that in the last recession something like this was done.
Mr. Chair.
And of course, perhaps some comment about how this long-term investment account ended up embedded in a essentially a rainy day fund for education.
Okay.
I think some of the committee members, I'm sure, don't know the history of that, and I think it would be useful to go over that a little bit. It's a lesson, I think, in constitutional law, politics and policy sort of all mixed together.
Yes, Mr. Chair, it's also a lesson kind of worthy goals that don't quite fit together.
Yes.
Because of history, and that's kind of, I think, what the legislature and with the help of the treasurer has been kind of wrestling with over the last few years. To go back to the original education endowment account, it really was a concept of then Senate President Gordon Smith, who, with revenue jumping in the lottery as a result of the video poker introduction in 91, and it began to grow much faster than we had projected in 93-95. The Senate had developed a bill that would set aside this 10% of those dollars flowing in so that they could be used for first of all, they set aside 15% that would go into the Education Endowment Fund, and then 10% of that would flow into this Venture Capital Fund, with the idea being that these would be long-term investments to seed venture capital in Oregon, encourage new technology. And the thinking at the time was with an endowment fund that would eventually generate earnings. You do see other aspects of this Education Stability Fund now as well. That the earnings on the Education Stability Fund, interest earnings, don't go back into the fund. Instead, 75% goes to pay lottery bonds for schools, and another 25% of those earnings go to the Oregon Student Assistance Commission. So that's a legacy also of that endowment fund, with the thinking that that corpus would grow of that fund. It would be a long-term fund, which would provide revenue over time, And therefore, liquidity was not a critical issue with the fund.
Right.
And that was the idea of setting aside this 10%. And of course, when you think about it, when you've got venture capital investments, those generally are not very liquid, particularly when times are tough economically. You can't just sell those assets and use those dollars.
And what you just said is a serious understatement, isn't it?
Yes.
Those funds are absolutely not liquid.
Absolutely not liquid, and particularly in tough economic times, are even less liquid. So so that's how the fund stood in 2002 when the recession started. Legislature met June of 2002 and referred a measure to the public that changed that endowment fund into the Education Stability Fund. And in the process of doing that, the thinking of the legislature was not to change these other aspects of the fund, to try to continue to do these other elements. For example, 25% of earnings on the Education Stability Fund still goes to the Oregon Student Assistance Commission. So what that means is if you have to use a big portion of the fund, which probably you will in the current environment, the earnings automatically goes down for the Student Assistance Commission. So you've got those kind of secondary effects that are a result of that legacy. And the other element of this is the 10% of the revenue in the Education Stability Fund continue to flow into the Oregon Growth Account. And that's where you have, I cited the numbers, you have $92 million now in the Oregon Growth Account. Those dollars are really not available if you need to balance the budget, because they're not liquid assets. So that's where you've been in a situation where you look at the overall size of the Education Stability Fund, but if you just look at that top-line number, it's not reflective of the amount of dollars you actually have available to help balance the budget in the short term. So, and that, again, that's the rationale behind this. It's not that there's been necessarily a change in policy regarding the Oregon Growth Account. It's just that its original framework of being set in the Education Endowment Fund is not nearly the same framework it is in now with the Education Stability Fund that obviously has more liquidity needs if it's going to truly be an effective reserve fund.
Thank you. And perhaps you could talk a little bit about the effect on the fund the fund that we're the Oregon Growth Account of the reduction of the transfer. I know that we did a study in, I think it was 07, you and I, around funds actually going into that fund, the call on the fund, how much of it was unallocated, how much of it was allocated, how much was actually invested. And my recollection is that our conclusion from that was that a temporary reduction in the amount transferred into the fund would have little or no effect on the, assuming past practices, on the treasurer's ability to allocate those funds for investment in venture capital arenas. Now, you may have a different recollection. I'd like to hear about that. I think the committee needs to know what the effect of this bill has not only on the increasing amount available in the Education Stability Fund that we can actually use, but also the effect that it would have on the Oregon Growth Account, if any, in the short term.
Mr. Chair, as I recall, it did take us a while to sort through those flow of funds and where they ultimately were going, particularly matching up with what DAS had recorded and what we received from the Treasury. But we've updated those numbers and working on Senate Bill 496 on the Senate side. And now the numbers we had, and these numbers go back to March when we worked on it there, there was roughly $6 million, there's about $98 million that were in the Oregon Growth Account. Roughly $6 million was in a liquid asset account that hadn't been committed. $92 million had been committed to venture capital partners. And of that $92 million, $46 million had been actually invested by those partners. The way the growth account works, the growth account board decides how to allocate and allocates to different venture firms and allocates them across based on their recommendations and based on their assessment of the potential long-run earnings of those various funds and investments. But the actual investments are done by those venture firms. So there'll be a commitment to them, which is the $92 million. They've invested $46 million now in actual companies, but there's another $46 million that's been committed that's on call. So that $92 million we would see as being illiquid and not available without breaking contracts that the Oregon Growth Board has entered into.
The Treasurer has committed funds to venture capital firms, which the firms have not actually invested.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So that would be the status now of the fund. One thing I will say, some of the numbers you've seen about the Education Stability Fund that are reported by DAS and the reserve accounts, I think they had that overhead for you in the May 15 forecast. Now they show $394 million as the balance for the Education Stability Fund. That does not include the $98 million that's in the Oregon Growth Account. So that's already taken out. So they've done that. So that these numbers, whatever numbers you get here, would be in addition to that 394.
Okay.
Now, of course, the other element of this is if you're changing, if this bill becomes law, you're changing the allocation over the next 2 years. So you instead of committing 10%, you'd be committing 5%. The other 5% would flow back into the general fund.
Into the
general Education Stability Fund
right.
account. So if you look at the growth projected in the May 15 forecast, we would anticipate about roughly a $20 million difference. We're projecting about $203 million to go into the Education Stability Fund in 2009-11. And that number would be bumped up to $230 million if you approve this bill. That would be generally available dollars. I'm sorry, it should be 220 because you'd have to take the 10 out for the 5% commitment. So it would go up to about $210 million as a result of this action. Those dollars are not in balances now, but in the 03 legislature, the flow of revenue into the Education Stability Fund was actually used as part of the budget balancing operations by passing a bill that transferred those dollars from the Stability Fund to the State School Fund in May of the end of the biennium, so you could May of 2011, for example, in this timing. So those dollars would be potentially available to help balance the 2009-11 budget.
Thank you. Questions or comments? This gets a little bit dense fairly quickly. But what this bill, as I understand it, essentially does is it fine-tunes the fund, the money going into this fund, for a short while during the budget emergency, and then it calls for a report in February of 2011. Summarizing the performance of the growth account and containing a recommendation as to whether the diversion of funds made by this bill should continue or whether we should go back to the current law on July 1st, 2013. That's my understanding. From the Treasurer's office.
Yes, Mr. Chair. And the bill itself is a little tricky because what it does in the first section, it sets up the 5%, and then in the section two, it restores the 10%. So you've got those both occurring, but then if you look down in section seven, it says section two becomes operative July 1, 2013.
Right.
So this the 10% comes back.
This has a built-in sunset, as it were.
Yeah. So we go back to current law. And the thinking here and the way this is constructed is that that decision would be based on this report and discussions with the treasurer based on that report. And so the legislature would decide if they'd want to make any longer-term changes regarding the diversion into the fund.
Do we know what the treasurer's position is on this bill?
We do have Michael Salvacchio is here from the Treasury, and he's available for comments. As I said, the senators met with the treasurer and kind of worked out the elements of this, so they've been involved all along.
Good. Good morning.
Good morning, Chair Barnhart.
Thank you for being here this morning.
Certainly. I'll preface my comments by saying that the certified smart people are all at this moment addressing the Oregon Investment Council, or at least staffing it. But I will try to answer any questions as best as I can up here and answer any further questions beyond that offline.
And for the record, you are?
I apologize. For the record, Michael Salvaggio from the Office of the State Treasurer. The Treasurer's Office has no objections to Senate Bill 496 in reference to the earlier question regarding the viability of the Oregon Growth Account. The temporary reduction in disbursement will not affect the long-term viability of the program. It will obviously have a temporary reduction of the investment capability, but will not be a detrimental in the long run. Well, most of my testimony has already been gone over by your capable staff, so I will just simply take any questions that you might have.
Thank you. I'm sure there are some. Representative Bentz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to follow up on the remark about the commitment of funds, I think Dr. Warner reported that $92 million had been committed. Is that it, then? The commitment by this group is not greater than the $92
million? Chair Barnhart, Representative Benz, as is my understanding, and I believe I have a email to that effect, if I can stall for just a few moments. The my understanding is that current commitments are $92 million or a little less, and that includes money that's actively invested in the money, that money that's been committed for investments. I will do my best to verify the specifics of your question, and we'll be more than happy to send a response to all members of the committee.
Thank you. Representative Bentz.
Thank you. I was curious if it was, if the commitment was the $92 million or if it was the $92 million plus the 5%, what used to be 10%, reduced amount, and if that 5% is essential to meet those commitments. That's my question. If the $92 million is indeed all that's been committed, then that would be, that would reduce the focus we would have to make upon the 5%.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, the commitments are composed of money that's already in the Oregon Growth Account. The reduction that's being considered by this bill will not affect the OGA's ability to live up to those commitments.
Yes, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that money that has not yet been committed, that's liquid. It's not in some other investment format. It's really there, is my question.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, I'm not. That's one of the questions that I'm afraid I'm going to have to defer to the smart people. I'm not absolutely sure in what form those funds take, but I would be happy to again get back to the committee with a more learned and precise answer.
Thank you. Thank you, Paul. Do you know the answer to that question?
Mr. Chair, I believe that the committed funds are retained in the short-term capital fund. So they're like balances in the general fund, the same account. So they're generating money market type rates of return, and they're liquid until those investments actually take place. But again, those are committed. They're committed dollars in terms of commitment to the venture capital firms as they look for those investment opportunities. But the actual physical dollars themselves, I think, are in the short-term capital fund.
Right. That was my recollection from our study a couple of years ago, was that the committed funds that had not actually been invested were maintained in an account by the Treasury.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, they certainly are retained in an account within the Treasury, but I wouldn't want to speculate about the liquidity of those funds, as a misstep there might have dire consequences.
Right. Perhaps you should check on that and get back to us about that. Representative Vance?
Nothing further at this point.
Thank you. Other questions? All right. Thank you. Thank you very much. Is there anyone else who would like to be heard today on Senate Bill 496? All right. With that, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 496.
Yes, we're here at 4 o'clock. We're here at House Bill 2016. We should have the amendments this morning.
So if I recess, then I carry everything over.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Committee, we're meeting at 4 o'clock this afternoon. We expect to have amendments on the bill that's posted for that time, and we will consider that and also any additional items that are on our agenda today that we get to. I understand that members have other commitments, and I would ask that you come to the committee after 4 o'clock when you are able. I expect that we will be taking action sometime after 5 o'clock on the bill. Do we have the amendment for that bill?
The latest, I see Dave shaking his
head. We don't have it. So it may be that we'll take action today. It may be that we won't actually take action until tomorrow.
Mr. Chairman, our word is we will get them sometime this morning.
Yeah.
So.
Well, we've heard that before, and we'll assume that's correct after it happens.
But we can get those to the members as soon as we can.
That would be great. Once they're available, we'll ask them to be distributed immediately, so you'll have a chance to look at them. And with that, members, we're going to stand in recess until 4 o'clock this afternoon.